Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Everything is fine. I know because Jay Powell told me so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 26th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here with the American economy in the fall of 2018 in three stanzas, performed today by Fed Chair Jay Powell. Mr. Chairman, the mic is yours.
Our economy is strong. Growth is running at a healthy clip. Unemployment is low. The number of people working is rising steadily. And wages are up. Inflation is low and stable.
Now, the second stanza, the transition.
All of these are very good signs.
And the third stanza, the hedge.
Of course, that's not to say that everything is perfect. The benefits of this strong economy have not reached all Americans. Many of our country's economic challenges are beyond the scope of the Fed, but my colleagues and I are doing all we can to keep the economy strong, healthy, and moving forward.
Bottom line, the economy is doing well enough that the Fed felt comfortable enough today to raise the short-term interest rate of controls another 0.25% to 2.25%. Chair Powell took questions for about an hour. Some were a tad weedy, some more newsy on the impact of trade and tariffs, for instance. First, from the chairman, came the disclaimer.
So I guess I need to start by saying that we're not responsible for trade policy, and we don't comment on particular trade actions and that sort of thing.
And then came the but.
We've been hearing a rising chorus of concerns from businesses all over the country about disruption of supply chains, materials cost increases, and loss of markets and things like that.
Which, in that way that the global economy goes, gets us to the corporate story of the day, led by this piece of audio from Jim Hackett. He's the CEO of the Ford Motor Company, speaking today at a Bloomberg event.
From Ford's perspective, the metals tariffs took about $1 billion of profit from us, which the irony is we source most of that in the U.S. today anyways.
The metal tariffs, of course, are the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs that got this whole import tax ball rolling this past spring. The interesting bit of what Hackett said is that this is where the tariff story veers firmly into the "that is the way they're supposed to work" lane. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that one.
When the Trump administration slapped a 25% tariff on steel shipped to the U.S. in June, the idea was we raise the price of foreign steel, and that'll force companies that need the raw material to buy domestic instead. John Bozzella runs the trade group Global Automakers. He says we forgot one thing about tariffs.
U.S. steel producers, because they're protected now from foreign competition, have raised their prices almost to the same level of the tariffs.
Domestic steel companies are seeing a boost to their bottom lines. One of the biggest, U.S. Steel, projects record revenue growth by the end of this year. But a much larger group is losing out. American and foreign companies that manufacture in the U.S. and firms that export goods from this country.
But our exports to other countries around the world have now gotten more expensive because other countries are retaliating.
By imposing tariffs of their own on goods exported from the U.S., automakers face some stiff headwinds right now. Car sales are down just as they say they need to maximize profits to pay for newer, safer cars and compete technologically. Ed Kim is vice president of industry at the research firm Auto Pacific.
Whether you're Ford or whether you're Toyota or Honda, this is bad news no matter who you are.
He says many car companies are eating up the higher steel prices for now, but pretty soon, he says, they'll hit consumers too. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
On that last bit from Renata, by the way, about tariffs eventually affecting consumers, so too will the Fed's steady raising of interest rates, and soon, too. We put together an explainer of where in your wallet those interest rates might hit you. It's at marketplace.org. NAFTA is still, although it's faded from the headlines a tad, it is still being renegotiated. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he is going to stay in talks as long as it takes to get a deal that is good for Canada. President Trump led his press conference this afternoon talking about NAFTA and what a bad deal it has been for the United States, as he's been saying for a number of years now. The Trump administration, in fact, says Sunday is the deadline. Got to have U.S.-Canadian agreement by Sunday or Ottawa might be left behind. Why Sunday, you ask? Yeah, me too. Seems there's a press on to get a deal done before Mexico's current president leaves office December the 1st, and also a bunch of procedural things that have to happen before pen is put to paper. But how firm, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson asks, is that Sunday deadline really?
U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer warned yesterday that if an updated NAFTA wasn't signed by the current Mexican president, we'd have to start a new negotiation with the new president.
I was pretty puzzled why he said that, actually.
Inu Monik is a visiting scholar at the Cato Institute who's been following these negotiations.
Everyone I know on the Mexican side and people who follow Mexican politics have said this is not a problem for Mexico, that they're not going to reopen negotiations.
Monik says signing the deal would be a feather in the cap of outgoing President Enrique Peña Nieto, and something the incoming president would rather not have to take on. Sure, changing administrations might introduce a little bit of uncertainty, says Gustavo Flores Macias at Cornell University. But President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador has signaled support for overhauling NAFTA, and he's had his own negotiator in on the talks.
I think if this deadline is missed, a new administration would probably continue along the same lines.
Plus, he says getting a deal done now would have political benefits for the Trump administration.
To be able to craft a narrative for the November elections, the midterm elections, sort of saying that President Trump has actually followed through on an important campaign promise.
So this deadline might be more motivational than drop dead, says Ishwar Prasad with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
This somewhat artificial deadline may have been contrived by the Trump administration as a way of putting greater pressure on Canada to come to the table and sign a deal that includes all three countries.
Canada might not find the deadline as motivating as Washington would like. So far, it's been insisting a deal can't be hurried. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
I'm going to go back to the Jay Powell well one more time here by way of explaining why Wall Street was slightly displeased with what the Fed did today. It's all about one word, seriously, one word of the 250 or so in the statement that the Fed issued after its meeting. That word is accommodative, which is Fed speak for low interest rates. Here's Chair Powell one last time.
Readers of the FOMC statement likely noted that the committee dropped a sentence that indicated that the stance of monetary policy remains accommodative. This change does not signal any change in the likely path of policy. Instead, it is a sign that policy is proceeding in line with our expectations.
Or as Chair Yellen used to say, we are going to let the data tell us what to do. President Trump, in fact, said today at that presser I mentioned that the Fed raised interest rates because the economy is doing so well, which is not wrong. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, to housing now. One of the reasons, and there were many, but one of the reasons the housing market crash did such damage to this economy was that people started looking at their houses as a source of cash. Cash to be taken out and spent on anything from a new fridge to a vacation in Barbados to a new BMW. And maybe we learned our lesson because homeowners are sitting on a record $6 trillion in home equity right now, equity that they could cash out or borrow against, but they're not. At least not as much as you might expect, and not for a lack of trying by the big banks. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
3 years ago, Job Fickett and his wife bought a four-bedroom ranch house in Jacksonville, Florida, for $263,000. He's a lawyer. She works for a commercial real estate brokerage. And today?
We haven't had it officially appraised, but according to some of the apps and whatnot, our house is worth over, you know, $325,000, $330,000 now.
That increase in value, along with the mortgage payments they've made, means they have more equity in the home. Equity is the market value of a house minus the outstanding debt. And Fickett says he and his wife have been tempted to tap theirs through a home equity loan or line of credit.
We just wanted to kind of do some upgrades to the kitchen, updating the appliances, putting in a wine fridge, that sort of thing.
Or
potentially trying to pay down some of our student loans, which have a higher interest rate.
According to research firm Black Knight Data and Analytics, Americans have amassed $6 trillion in what's known as tappable home equity. That's the amount homeowners could cash out while keeping a 20% stake in the home, a conservative threshold for many lenders. Black Knight's director of market research, Andy Walden, says equity is growing because home prices are growing.
They're up 50% from the bottom of the market. They're up 10% from where they were in 2006. So as those home prices rise, borrowers' equity positions improve.
So far, though, Walden says homeowners have resisted cashing out, at least at levels you might expect. He says the percentage of available equity people are extracting through a cash-out refinancing or home equity line of credit has been falling for the past few years. Americans have learned the hard way that home prices go down, too.
Certainly lessons learned both on the lending side and the borrowing side from the financial crisis are at play. Another thing that we're tracking here early on this year is the impact of rising interest rates on borrowers' willingness to utilize equity in their home.
Rising interest rates make new loans less appealing, and so does the new tax law. It caps the interest borrowers can deduct for home loans, and the money has to be spent to buy or improve a home to qualify. Still, the temptation may be too great. Greg McBride is chief financial analyst at Bankrate. In a recent survey, he says 15% of respondents considered paying regular household bills a good use of home equity.
With the sorry state of emergency savings for many people, it's only a matter of time before a lot of homeowners have to resort to that home equity, either to consolidate other debts or when they have an unexpected home repair expense.
Banks are happy to help, even offering loans and home equity lines of credit of up to 90% of a home's value. With delinquencies low, McBride says they've stepped up their marketing.
Looking for a home equity loan?
A home reno couldn't cost that much. Cut it?
A HELOC can help to make your plans a reality.
Job Fickett, the homeowner in Jacksonville, says every time he checks his bank account or mortgage balance online,
you get a landing splash page that says, yeah, you should really look into refinancing your house. You should really look into a home and equity line. It only takes 5 minutes to find out what you might get.
He's holding off for now. The Jacksonville housing market feels a bit bubbly, he says. And at not quite 30 years old, he remembers his parents' struggles to sell a home during the last downturn. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We started today with the central bank, for whom issues of national economic policy are their daily fare. We continue in our series My Economy with a far more personal kind of banking from the north of Scotland.
My name is Anne Rendell, and for work, I'm a flying banker. Orkney is a group of islands off the north coast of Scotland. Being a group of islands, we don't have a branch on every one of them, so instead of that, I fly out each day to a different island. As far as I know, there is nowhere else in the world that they have the same type of service. And as I say, I've been doing this for 30 years now. I leave the main office in the morning and go out to the airport and catch a small 8-seater plane and go out to one of the more remote islands and spend my day there providing a banking service to our customers and then come back in the afternoon. It's a lifeline service for the people that actually live in the islands. They have transport, they can get into Kirkwall, but it means, you know, they're away from home for the whole day if they come in by boat or by plane. Small businesses can't afford to take a whole day off work. So if I can be there and do their business for them, that's a great advantage for them. Obviously, when you're flying, you're at the mercy of the weather. So there's wind and rain and snow and fog and all types of weather that you have to contend with when you're flying out there. So it's certainly a part of the job. I just love flying, and in any type of weather, it's quite exciting when it's bouncing about. I really like, you know, the personal relationship with the customers, because you're going every week or every month, you get to know them and you get to know them, and then over the years they start coming in with their children and their children's children, so you're getting to see the generations coming in to see you and opening their accounts, and so it's a nice continuity of service.
Anne Rendell, the Flying Banker, her story was produced for us by our friends at the BBC for our series My Economy, which, by the way, cannot happen without your help. So take a second, let us know how your personal economy is doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Hello. Hello. Yes, go ahead.
Why calling 911 is getting harder to do. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 106 today, 0.4%, 26,385. NASDAQ shaved off 17 points, about 0.2%, 79.90. The S&P 500 dropped 9 points, 0.3%, 29.05. Remember, the word of the day is accommodative. J.P. Morgan Chase down 0.1%. Morgan Stanley lost 1.2%. Today, we heard from Renata Sago about Ford putting a number on those metal tariffs, $1 billion. Ford shares dipped 0.1%. Today, McDonald's says most of its burgers are now preservative-free. Big Macs and Quarter Pounders now have reformulated buns and sauces. The pickles, though, still artificially preserved. McDonald's shares grew staler by 0.3%. And yeah, I still don't understand pickle slushies, whatever those were. I don't know. You're listening to Marketplace. Every day, you make economic decisions that affect your life, including choices that aren't obviously about money. That's why Marketplace covers business and finance from so many different angles in a way that is smart, relatable, and even kind of fun. To keep public service journalism going strong, please go to Marketplace.org today and become a Marketplace investor with a donation in any amount. And we do appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We know you have tariff questions, and we try to answer them from time to time, sometimes by talking to people whose job it is every day to deal with those tariffs firsthand. Gretchen Blau is one such person. She's a customs broker, a licensed customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania. Gretchen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can I do a little listener Q&A with you, please?
Sure.
Okay. And I apologize for putting you on the spot. We get a lot of questions from listeners. The two most basic ones are, who pays these tariffs?
Well, they eventually get passed along to the consumer. The importer initially pays them, but right. I strongly suspect everyone is going to be paying them soon. So,
okay. Question number two is, mm-hmm. where does that money go?
That goes into the general fund. So it doesn't necessarily go to pay anything customs related.
But the general treasury is where it goes, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right.
So what exactly does a customs broker do, first of all?
Well, I end up explaining this to a lot of people.
I'm sure you do, and I apologize.
That's okay. So we have to take a very extensive test and go through a licensing program. Oh. And then we get to file the entries on all of the commodities coming into the U.S. And we have to classify everything. We have to make sure it's valued properly. We have to make sure all the details that an importer gives us are correct. And then we submit that to customs. And either the importer pays the duties directly, or we pay it on their behalf and then charge the importer.
Yeah.
And then we make sure everything's taken care of.
Wow.
So
this is a very bald question, but I guess business is really good right now if you're a customs broker. I mean, you must be, you know, doing all right.
It's very busy.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. Because there's such an extensive testing process, and I think the pass rate is under 4% every time they give it. They give the test, and they give it twice a year.
Wow.
There's not a lot of us out there. So also we need to see how our own volume is going to continue, because if people are not importing as much, then maybe it's not such a good time to be a customs broker.
Good point.
If our business falls off.
The most recent batch, though, this new batch that went into effect Monday with, you know, 5,000 and I think it's 5,027 line items.
Mm-hmm.
Is that now just an order of magnitude more difficult for you?
Yeah. The first few were a couple of pages front and back. I think one was 12 and one was 5. And this one I had to get out the special stapler because it's close to half an inch thick.
Wow. What are you hearing from your clients and your customers about how they're adapting? Are they going to Vietnam and Taiwan for their import stuff? Are you seeing that change happen in the bills of lading that you get or whatever?
They've been doing a lot of research. They haven't had a lot of time to do a lot of research. There are certain commodities that some of our importers are finding are not readily available anyplace other than China. So that has been a little bit problematic. They've also looked at bringing in the machinery to build some of the stuff into the U.S., but now a lot of that machinery is made in China, and it was on this third list. So they want that option.
What are your clients telling you they are most worried about? What goods are most challenging for them?
Furniture, lighting. I made a joke at a meeting that we were talking to one of our clients that, well, if you're planning on redecorating, now's the time to do it before everything goes up. I know from my own personal perspective, I'm putting a metal roof on the house.
Oh, wow.
So I'm getting it done now.
You know what? You go with the information you have, right? I mean, I guess that's
exactly.
The name of the game. Gretchen Blau, she's a customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania. Gretchen, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
There are some infrastructure givens in this economy today. You flip the switch, you expect the lights to come on. You turn on the faucet, water is supposed to come out. You dial 911, you expect to hear, 911, what's your emergency? But increasingly, those call centers are struggling with outdated technology, staff shortages, and tight budgets as well. From Arkansas Public Media, Sarah Weitz-Kotacek has more on why emergency response sometimes isn't.
Little Rock 911, what's the address of your emergency?
Marilyn Scott is a retired police officer and 911 call taker for the city of Little Rock.
Ma'am, it was doing what? Ma'am, I'm sorry. You're pulling the phone away from your mouth. I can't hear you.
She's one of 3 to 4 people working at any given time fielding emergency calls, and the pressure is intense. The call center handles an average of 71 calls an hour during the day.
Hello? Hello? Yes, go ahead.
In this recording from July, the caller eventually reveals she's a Walmart employee concerned about a customer who'd been asked to leave earlier in the week. So Scott sends the police. By the time they arrive, the customer is gone.
Because you can't go fast enough, the phones are usually always ringing. The people on the other end of the phone don't understand why you're in a hurry, but you're in a hurry to get another call.
The call center is short-staffed by about 10 people. Last year, the city raised annual call taker pay to about $35,000 to keep workers. That's up from roughly $29,000. But even so, there's a high turnover rate. Lots of people get trained and then quit. Call center director Captain Ty Tyrell says it's hard to retain staff because they're often asked to work overtime and it's an emotionally difficult job.
We got somebody here 24 hours a day. The pay for what they do and the role they play in the emergency response is relatively low.
The staff shortage isn't lost on residents like Whitney Patterson Steele. She lives in an area with high crime. She's called 911 a few times after she heard gunshots. She says sometimes she's waited up to 5 minutes for an answer. So she just hangs up and calls again.
It's to the point where when I call, I don't know if I'm going to get a reliable response. It makes me nervous when I start to call because I'm like, okay, I really need to report this, but I don't know if I'm going to get anybody.
Arkansas Public Media reviewed city data from May and June and found 15% of calls were abandoned by callers before someone picked up. Overall, Little Rock's 911 answered 67% of calls within 10 seconds in the first half of 2018. That's short of the industry standard of 90%. Brian Fontes is CEO of the National Emergency Number Association. He says 911 faces challenges nationwide.
The 911 world is kind of the forgotten public safety service, and yet it's the one used most by the public.
911 call centers are funded largely through fees all of us pay on our phone bills. But FCC data from 2016 show those fees accounted for only about 3/4 of the cost to operate the system nationwide in that year. States and municipalities were on the hook to cover the rest. Fonte says tight budgets are partly why 911 has yet to enter the digital era. Most call centers, he says, can't afford to buy equipment to automatically show a caller's location or receive texts or videos.
much of 911, as we see it today, is what I call last century technology. It's voice-centric.
Almost all states are somewhere in the process of digitizing 911. That will allow call takers to remotely step in to another city's call center when it becomes overwhelmed. Legislation introduced in Congress would pay for the capital expenses of 911 digitization nationwide, but there's still no price tag for those changes in the bill. In Little Rock, I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, from which you should draw no conclusions, it is just a data point. TrimTabs Investment Research reported this week that corporate executives are selling their own company's stock at a rate not seen in 10 years. To be clear, this isn't insider trading, which is illegal. It's just selling, which is fine. August's numbers were 10-year records as well. And remember, just a data point. All right, we got to go on this September Fed day. The Dow Industrials 106 points to the downside, 0.4%. NASDAQ shaved off 17 points, 0.2%. S&P 500 down 9.3%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.